Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Michael Meyer, whose book is titled In Manchuria, A Village Called Wasteland and the Transformation of Rural China. This is Michael Meyer's second book. The first is called The Last Days of Old Beijing. Michael Meyer has lived in Beijing and lived in a village called Wasteland. went to school in Berkeley. And I guess you're from Minnesota, correct?
Yeah, my family's all Californians, but they moved me to Minnesota to raise me, and then they all moved back to California.
That actually does play a role because you were able, while you were living in Manchuria, you were able to compare notes between life in Minnesota and life in Manchuria. The book, In Manchuria, is a combination, I guess, of three or four different ideas, one of which is a history of Manchuria. One is your life in a village in Manchuria. It's also a travel book about traveling through Manchuria. So let's start at the very, very beginning. What is Manchuria? Let's define Manchuria before we even begin. What are its borders?
The name in English has sort of fallen out of favor over the years. In Chinese, you say Dongbei, which means the northeast. We're talking about the region just north of the Great Wall. On the other side of the Great Wall, Chinese say that the map of their nation resembles the outline of a chicken. So Manchuria would be the chicken's head. It's bordered by North Korea, by Siberia, by Mongolia. It's a region that geographically is about the same area as Germany and France combined, and its population equals those countries. It's 110 million people living up here. But it's always been a sort of land apart from China proper over the centuries.
And at the southern end, it's the border, I guess, is the Great Wall?
Correct.
So that's the area, and it's very distinct because the peoples from Manchuria are different from the people from the rest of China, or were at one point.
They are on two levels. One is the ethnic people that come from this region, the Manchu, which give the area its English name, or its formerly used English name, came south over the Great Wall in the early 17th century and conquered all of China. And this was the last dynasty of China, including the last emperor who abdicated in 1912. But when you think of the map of China today, most of its border regions were added during this Manchu dynasty, Xinjiang, Tibet, Taiwan, the northeast, Inner Mongolia. Those people are sort of a breed apart. But so are the people who live there now, because unlike the rest of China, when you walk into a village, you don't see an ancestral shrine, you know, with generations listed going back 17 generations. Instead, this is an area of migration that a lot of people came to this region in the 1850s onward. And so it feels different than the rest of China, too, in that it's relatively new compared to the rest of China. You know, you often, when you're in China, you hear China has 5,000 years of history. You hear that over and over again. But the recorded history of this land is closer to 400, equaling, you know, when the pilgrims settled or came to Plymouth Rock in 1620.
And on top of that, as you say in Manchuria, the knowledge of history is fairly empty. People don't really talk about history that much. Now, you lived in Beijing, you taught in Beijing, and you learned Chinese.
Yeah, I originally went to Peace Corps 20 years ago. I'm sorry, China with the Peace Corps 20 years ago this summer. So I first lived in southwest China. I was one of the first Peace Corps volunteers. I became fluent in Chinese there, then moved to Beijing and learned how to read Chinese and lived there several years working as a teacher, as a journalist, and then writing The Last Days of Old Beijing. But you're right, in Beijing, you know, history is all around you, and people in Beijing are very proud of their history and want to talk your ear off about it the same way that New Yorkers do. But it's different up in the north.
And while you were there, you met Frances. Mm-hmm. You married her. She's an attorney. I guess you lived together in Berkeley at one point. And is she still in Hong Kong?
No. Frances and I met at an international school in Beijing while we were teaching. We both came back to Berkeley for graduate school. My wife graduated from law school here. And then while I was researching this book, which is actually Wasteland, the village in this book, is her hometown. So while I was in her hometown, she was practicing as an attorney in Hong Kong. And originally, we thought we would live together in the village. But after about a week back in her village, she said, boy, I feel like a young Chinese girl again, the way people are treating me, like I'm an 8-year-old. And she said, how would you like it if I moved back to your hometown in Minnesota and wrote a book and asked you to give up your career to stay here with me? So I understood why she turned tail and left for Hong Kong, where she worked as an attorney.
And now you're both back in the States?
We are in Singapore officially, but I'm teaching in Pittsburgh. So this is a bit of a challenging commute for me because I'm at University of Pittsburgh where I teach in the MFA program. I'm a professor of English in the writing program. So I'm there during the school year, and then I'm commuting constantly to Singapore where Francis is now working as an attorney.
What all this means, Michael Meyer,
yes.
is that when you were living in Wasteland, mm-hmm. you basically had family there, which puts you in a very different position than a foreigner because mm-hmm. you sort of have to be adopted as a hometown boy.
It had pluses and minuses. The plus was, you're right, in this village, because I was the only foreigner that had ever lived there or had passed through, at least in the past 100 years, it's a 20-square-mile area with only 1,500 people living in it. So it's much different than, say, in southern China with a high population density. So I stand out like a sore thumb. I kind of look like a kangaroo bounding down the street if you looked out your window today. And so when people in the Northeast, when they meet you, they don't say what Chinese usually say in greeting, which is, chifan le mao, have you eaten? Instead, in Wasteland, they say, shei jia dia, which means, whose family do you belong to? And it was very important for me as a writer to be able to say, oh, I belong to the Fengs. This is my family that I belong to. They could place me and they could feel safe around me. What was challenging about this, though, in the Beijing book for 3 years, I lived among strangers and wrote their life stories. That was easier than writing about family. Because with family, resentments really do steep like tea leaves. And I was constantly being edited as I was doing my reporting about, you can't put that in. And make sure you say this instead. You know, and that was a larger challenge.
Has your family seen the finished book?
They have. And it's very funny. Just like the character, when the Beijing book came out, the original reaction of people in the neighborhood was, where are our photos? We want our pictures in this book to represent our lives here, which were added later. With this book, what people have seen is that their photos are in, and of course they said, that's not a very flattering photo. You know, we want a better photo of ourselves instead. But the Beijing book did come out in Chinese. This book will also come out in Chinese, I'm hoping.
Let's talk first about your life in Wasteland, and then we'll go into some other issues regarding the history mm-hmm. and the travel. You wound up in the, I'm going to get pronunciations wrong, of course, but in the home of Mr. Guan?
Yeah, Mr. Guan, that's correct.
Oh, and you didn't have indoor plumbing, and that struck me as kind of strange in a 21st century town.
Especially for a town that's comparatively modern, like Wasteland. So I had an outhouse, but I had very fast broadband internet. You know, this is sort of the line we straddle in 21st century China. A lot of farmers were improving their houses and adding indoor plumbing or adding a sort of leach field arrangement, you know, where they could have a flush toilet in the house. It wouldn't go into a sewage system, but it would go out in under their garden. But because of what was happening in Wasteland, about half of the farmers chose not to improve their homes because they knew their homes were slated for demolition. So in our house, we didn't have that.
Well, slated for demolition if they wanted.
Exactly.
If they wanted it to be. Does that building still exist? Does that home still exist, or has it been torn down?
Ironically, my Beijing home, which I thought was going to be torn down, still stands. My farmhouse in Wasteland, which I thought would be there for generations, has since been torn down. And my roommate has very happily accepted the offer of a modern apartment in its stead and has moved there.
You have a photo of the new apartments, mm-hmm. Which I guess between Wasteland and Jilin?
Yes, correct. Jilin.
Jilin. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They look really awful. They look like slums just waiting to happen.
Yeah, it's that poured concrete, sort of no, 5-story walk-up, no distinctive characteristics, painted with a thin coat of paint that you know is going to chip and flake in those harsh Manchurian winds. Yeah, and this is an issue, you know, in the book. The transition that Wasteland was going through was that from a family-run village of small family-held farms to that of a village controlled by an agribusiness who were consolidating the farm plots and using mechanized systems to grow and harvest the rice. And as part of that bargain, the company said, well, we'll build new apartments for farmers so farmers won't have to move into the city. And in the schematics and the billboards they put up, they look beautiful. And, of course, in China, you often make agreements before the apartments are done. Often you buy an apartment sight unseen. And so when the apartments were finished, there were farmers who said, wait a minute, why am I trading our single-story house with a garden for, as you said, a sort of substandard, very cheaply made cement box, which was their apartment?
There was an article I saw in either the New Yorker or New York Times magazine mm-hmm. about these strange cities put up all over China, one of which looks like Paris.
You're right, these replica cities that they do, exactly, as a way to attract. You know, it's funny, I think in China, like, anything that adds to GDP is approved. So if you tear up a road, you're adding to GDP, that's good for the country. If you build shells of homes that, you know, are surrounded by a faux Eiffel Tower, that's good for GDP too as well, so you can get credit to do that. It doesn't matter if people actually move into them or not, but there are model villages that look like towns on the Thames River. There are model villages that look like, you know, slices of Austria or the Swiss Alps. Wasteland's not like that. Wasteland definitely looks like a flat plain with these odd sort of monopoly hotels placed on the prairie.
One of the things I noticed is this constant balance between what appears to be 19th century life and a Starbucks, just like with the Wi-Fi. Now, the Wi-Fi, you didn't have a Wi-Fi in your home. It came from somewhere.
It did come from somewhere. They ran a line out there, amazingly enough. You know, the Chinese government or the telecoms there, ever since the Olympics were held, sort of had a standing offer to anyone that if you wanted to be wired for the internet, by darn it, you could be. And so they came in and put the line in for my house. So I thought it was so odd. Again, I was using an outhouse, and yet I could sit and listen to live streaming baseball games in the summertime, you know, on my brick bed that was heated by burning rice chaff, you know, underneath it. We didn't even have central heat in our home. It was a fired bed, as it were.
These are the Kangs. And yeah. I went online to look at a Kang, and they look more like platform beds, but are they bigger than that? I mean,
the entire floor of my half of the house I lived in was a Kang. It was, you stepped into the door and then you stepped up on this platform. You're right, it is a large platform bed that in wintertime, you know, in the wasteland, the temperatures would average around minus 18 degrees Fahrenheit, but I could sit on top of this thing in my shorts and my T-shirt, and they're actually quite pleasant. After a while, you start to smell like baked bread. You know, you're roasting grain on top of your platform bed.
Noise.
Mm.
When we hear about China, certainly during the Mao years, mm-hmm. that seemed to be constant loudspeakers going.
That's right.
Still true?
No, those speakers have mercifully been taken down. And one thing that struck me after living in a very densely populated Beijing neighborhood and moving to the countryside is just how loud silence can be. After a while, every frog croak or cricket chirp or cell phone ringing. My cell phone, when it would the rare times it would go off, would actually startle me. You know, it would be so alarming to hear that because it was so quiet and still. And villagers say that, like, it didn't used to be this way. People would gather and have to sing songs or anthems, and these loudspeakers would wake you up in the morning reading the Communist Party organ newspaper over them. Those days, like I said, are thankfully gone.
There's also mention that there's very little police presence.
Yeah. Yeah, there is a police station in Wasteland that a couple people work in, but I never would see a patrol car. I would never see a policeman working a beat. The only time I would see cops on the streets is when a visiting official came and they had to have a motorcade, you know, come through town.
And you never found out who that was?
I would never find out. No, no one knew what officials would come or what they were actually doing there. The president of China, Hu Jintao, then president, visited this village in 2007 and sort of gave it its imprimatur for the kind of agriculture they were doing. But police presence was very minimal, and that's so different than Beijing, where when I moved into my house in that neighborhood to write the book, it took me months to convince the police to allow me to stay because they were such an ever-present part of the neighborhood. And in this book, the police really didn't even know I was there. You know, it took a good 2 years for them to say, hey, maybe you should come into the station, and we want to make sure you're not a missionary. You know, it was odd to sit down in front of a computer with them and show them pictures of my Beijing book and for have the cops to say, oh, you're only a writer. You're just a writer, which is the only time in China I've heard that as being a positive thing.
Is there very little crime then?
There's not a lot to steal. There's crime. I mean, people get drunk, and there's domestic violence, and there's petty thievery and things of that nature. But no, in the time I was there, no serious violence, you know, nobody was murdered, for example, no cars were stolen, no farm implements were taken. It's a place where you don't lock your door still, and everybody in the village really knows each other.
How ubiquitous are iPhones and flat-screen TVs?
Very. When I was a Peace Corps volunteer 20 years ago, you know, before the internet permeated all these corners of China, my students and I were quite isolated from the world, and they would ask questions, you know, along the lines of what is the capital of the United States of America, that sort of thing. What's a time zone? When I taught in the village here, my students knew Kobe Bryant's scoring average for the season. They knew all the lyrics to Lady Gaga's Poker Face because they would sit and play their MP3 songs, you know, during recess. And the kids had smartphones, and they were very connected to the world. It's a big change in the last 20 years.
And flat-screen TVs, have they made an impact?
You see TVs there. You know, there's not a lot to do in these farming villages, and I've heard Chinese anthropologists say that they can tell when they're approaching a village how much of traditional culture has eroded by counting the satellite dishes on tops of farmers' homes. Wasteland is a place where most farmers do have satellite dishes up on top of their houses. And they do have flat-screen TVs, and they're mad about watching, you know, not only the national news, but legal affairs programs, you know, sports, but then most of all these soap operas that are set in the Qing Dynasty or the Chinese version of the television program The Voice, these singing competitions that people love to watch.
Michael Meyer, before we move on from there, American culture is ubiquitous everywhere in the world, mm-hmm. and it seems to be America's biggest import.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you mentioned Lady Gaga, and you mentioned Kobe Bryant. Is that generally true of television, of film, beside music?
You know, the television programs not so much because Chinese are crazy about Korean soap operas. Everything from South Korea is very hot right now in China. But movies, definitely. And even in my classroom, I taught elementary and middle school students, and Friday afternoon was movie day, and the teachers in the school would bring the kids into one big room and go on to an illegal content provider on the internet, and they would show them things like Night at the Museum. So, you know, here I am watching Ben Stiller in the Natural History Museum in New York, and I could almost hear the sea train, you know, underneath the building 8,000 miles away. But the kids like watching those because they learn slang from them. They're subtitled in English and Chinese, so they can see things like, hold on a sec. You know, and they ask me, what does sec mean? Why do people say things like that? So I see that definitely going on in the countryside.
And they all want to get a better grasp of English then?
Definitely, yeah. There's a huge push for this. And it's an issue in minority areas like Tibet, Xinjiang, in Manchuria, where ethnic Manchu in the village do not speak the Manchu language or know how to read the Manchu language because in Chinese schools, Chinese obviously, Mandarin Chinese is the primary language of instruction. And if you're going to teach a foreign language, it's going to be English. It's not going to be your ethnic language. And so in the book, I do go to a village where the last three native Manchu speakers live. They're all in their late 80s. And there's a younger teacher there trying to teach kids in the village Manchu, and he's come under a lot of political pressure, saying, you can't do this in the school. That's their time to learn English. You can teach Manchu on the side after school, which he's doing.
What do they generally think of the U.S.?
You know, I've been there in China now. I first went 20 years ago, and I've come in and out over the past two decades. And no matter what is going on politically, when I say I'm an American, it usually brings a smile to the face of people. And it's really an issue not only about modernity to them. You know, America is a superpower like China once was during the Qing Dynasty and its dynasties before that. But there's also this sort of warm, fuzzy feeling about America and the notion of individual responsibility and individual freedoms that people can have, to the point where I've never seen more law books in my life in a home in China than in a farmer's house in Wasteland. They have these lined up. There's legal affair programs they listen to on the radio. They do, you know, call-in shows and newspaper columns about this. And the farmers there are constantly asking me about the legal system in America and what is due process and what rights do farmers have. And if the government wants to take your farm away from you, what avenues can you go through and so forth. So it's beyond just pop culture, I should say. There is an intense political interest and also sort of a governance and civil society interest in how America runs itself.
I think Jilin has Walmarts.
Yes.
And Starbucks, certainly, KFC.
Yep.
A few years ago, I was in Tokyo, and I went to a Denny's, and even though it was a Denny's, it was clearly Japanese.
You get an eggs over my hammy in Japanese, yeah.
When you walk into these places, how American do they feel, or how Chinese do they feel?
They actually feel Chinese, and that's a really good point you make. You know, I've been in China during times of protest before, where a mob will turn on a McDonald's or a KFC as a sign of Western imperialism or Western culture, and the manager will be out front saying, I own this. I'm Chinese, you know, it's a franchise. I'm in charge here. The menus are skewed towards Chinese tastes. And I honestly think that people like going to places like Starbucks and KFC because you can sit unmolested. There's no smoking inside. They're heated. They're air-conditioned. No waiter is going to come and chase you out of there. You know, people can linger. Oftentimes, you see people having first dates there. Journalists love these places to do interviews in because you're not being watched by other people. There's so much changeover anyway in the crowd. And it's rare in China to find places where you can just sit and sit quietly. There aren't a lot of benches in public parks. They don't want people assembling. You know, Tiananmen Square has nowhere to sit down, for example. So I think some of the attraction of these American restaurants is more sort of the culture around them than it is the menu itself.
Before we move into the history and the travel, mm-hmm. a couple of questions. There are three other people in the book who play a role in your life in Wasteland. Mm-hmm. Uncle Fu and Auntie Yi.
Yes.
And Auntie Yi's poppies by the side of the road, which are replaced because
yes.
the road is widened. And Sanju, your uncle?
Yes.
Is that the right pronunciation?
Sanjo.
Sanjo.
Yeah.
How are they all doing?
Well, they're doing well. You know, it's funny. When you're doing a book like this, there's only so many characters a Western reader especially can keep on the page. And so I was careful to choose people that were sort of representing different sides of the argument for the modernization of this village. And Sai Yi is a lifetime communist cadre. She is dyed-in-the-red Marxist. And she was very upset about the changes in the village because they were being implemented by a private company and not the government. She said they weren't adhering to the socialist road. Her husband, Uncle Fu, left central China and migrated to this region after serving in the Korean War at age 16. And so he was my protagonist as sort of a military veteran and a newcomer to this region and what he made out of it. Whereas Sanjo, my uncle, but through my extended family, is a farmer. And he's been working these fields for the last 50 years. And he's, from his take, it's I've lived through all these economic experiments and these different policies, and now finally at age 70, I can farm my field freely and sell my crop on the open market, and now here comes this company coming in to take over. Those three people are still in their houses, I'm happy to say. They have not been coerced to move out of them. They have not been coerced to sign their farm plot over to the company, but that pressure is increasing simply because their age is increasing. Sanjo suffered a minor stroke toward the end of this book, and he finds it increasingly difficult even to get out and weed his field. And this is a serious issue in Chinese villages. You know, the kids aren't allowed in the fields to work, by and large. Their parents only have one child, and they want him or her to go to school and go to the cities and find white-collar work rather than work the fields.
And that brings up something happening in the cities, which mm-hmm. is the bifurcation of classes, the
yes.
urban versus rural, which is something I'd never heard about.
Yeah, you know, China likes to promulgate the fact that it's a majority urban society now, that more people live in cities than they do in the countryside. But that's really misleading because 250 million of these migrants that move into cities are second-class citizens. They do not have the same access to state-provided health care. Their kids can go to, say, a Beijing elementary school only up through grade 6. They cannot sit for the middle school entrance exam to go to Beijing middle or high school, so they have to return to their villages. And so one of the things the government is doing now nationally is saying, you know, we should stop migrants from coming into the cities and instead bring the cities to them by developing these rural regions, which is what's happening in Wasteland.
And that's one of the reasons that the rural people are classified as rural, because back home they could get health care, but in the city they can't.
Exactly. And you're getting to the point now, it's funny, there's sort of a reversal going on in China, that many college graduates who come from rural areas that went to schools in cities, because the job competition is so strong right now, they're opting to go back to their village, because at least in their village, they are assigned a plot of land and have a guaranteed income for what they grow on it, rather than in the city where, say, they're queuing up, you know, 100 deep to try to get a job as a sales associate at Walmart.
But that's different from Wasteland, because mm-hmm. in Wasteland, if Eastern Fortune, the company, mm-hmm. the rice company, is taking over the whole village, then they don't have plots to go back to.
They don't. Technically, they still hold the rights to their plots. All land in China is owned by the state. So if you're a farmer, you have a 30-year leasehold on a plot of land. It's about an acre and a half, usually, the size of an American football field. But what agribusinesses, such as Eastern Fortune Rice, in this instance, are doing is they're coming into families and saying, why don't we contract your land for a 3-year period? You don't have to do a thing to it. We'll plant it. We'll harvest it. We'll sell the crop. We'll give you a guaranteed price so you can bank that money and you can find work elsewhere. And so what's happening in Wasteland is you have people coming back to the village. There are no empty houses. The village is full. But they're not necessarily working in the paddy, right? They're not actually planting rice. They're getting an income for Eastern Fortune for contracting their rice, but they're starting motorcycle repair shops, they're starting small restaurants, they're starting internet cafes, and in the case of some of my returned friends in the village, they're working at this hot spring resort that Eastern Fortune has built to attract city folk to come out and soak in our thermal waters out there.
And eventually it's possible Eastern Fortune will say, we own that land.
I think that's what's happening. I think, you know, China is constantly invoking the American model of agriculture, which in 1992, the U.S. Census stopped counting farmers because farmers in our country have become, quote unquote, statistically insignificant. Farms, as you know, in America are massive in size. The average crop farm to be viable needs to be about 3,000 acres. And so in China, this is the trend they're going toward, is that why don't we start stitching together these individual family plots into much larger corporate-managed farms, and the farmers that once worked these fields can now go into the service sector or these white-collar jobs like people in the States have done.
In Manchuria, Michael Meyer, is also a history book and a travel book. When you were setting out to work on this, when you decided to live in Wasteland, that was always the plan?
It was. I thought what I was doing originally was doing what Pearl Buck and her husband John Losing Buck did in the 20s before Pearl Buck wrote The Good Earth, which is to go out into villages and sort of collect lore. You know, look, I wanted to know. Pearl Buck used to go out and sit with women in houses and ask them, what do you feed your babies? What songs do you sing to them? To the point now where those books, a lot of Chinese intellectuals think Pearl Buck should be classified as Chinese literature because urban intellectuals only read about city folks. They didn't go out in the countryside. So I thought I was updating, you know, her work and showing what life was like in the countryside. I didn't expect the changes in the village to be going on. But once those changes started happening, I thought, okay, well, now I need to zoom out and show the reader how this area of the country has long experimented with different forms of government, with different forms of economic policy. All, I should note, have failed. But the land, the country, this area itself has cycled through these past 400 years of history, unlike anywhere else in China, which was why I go on these side trips to show the history of the region.
Well, when we're talking history in Manchuria, I noticed very, very little mention of Chairman Mao.
Yes.
And very, very little mention, except as in, oh, they came, they destroyed, they left.
Yeah.
The Red Guard.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's funny that the Communist Party didn't function here until its major victory in the Chinese Civil War happened here in 1948. But up until that point, you know, there was no guerrilla communist activity here the way there was in the South, or where the Long March went across southern China, ended up in Sichuan, and then where their caves in central China where they held out. This area was historically, you know, it was the Manchus' homeland up until 1912 when Puyi, the last emperor, abdicated. And around that same time, Russia had occupied the region and built an extensive railway network unlike any seen in China. This was an international zone long before Shanghai or other treaty ports ever were. And in Harbin, one Russian-built city alone, there was 53 nationalities speaking 45 languages in 1920. And then Japan occupied the region before they invaded China proper, 10 years before they bombed Pearl Harbor. There was a puppet state here called Manchukuo, which existed. So the Japanese occupied the region. And again, the communists didn't really enter here until 1948 in force when they defeated the KMT in the Civil War and then started these economic policies and so forth. But because the land was so new and a lot of this area was being open to agriculture for the first time in the 1950s, it didn't have the famine. It didn't have the horrible cultural revolution that other parts in China did in the late 60s, because there simply wasn't old antiquity to smash and destroy or old traditions to try to upend. It's rather new in that regard.
So when people aren't talking much about Mao and they're not talking much about the cultural revolution, it's not that they're avoiding the subject, it's just that it didn't have that much impact.
It wasn't as strong as it was in central and southern China. Now, having said that, though, I'm talking specifically about the rural regions, because the Northeast was the manufacturing base. It's where China's oil industry was. It's petering out up there now, but it was where most of the heavy industry was located. And this notion of the iron rice bowl, you know, that you would have this cradle to grave care from your work unit in your heavy manufacturing areas. But by the time I started my reporting, you know, I went up here for the first time in the late 90s, and this book carries us through about 2014 in the reporting. A lot of that state-owned industry had been dismantled. And so you'll still see names of roads like Defend Labor Boulevard or Increase Production Lane. But on those streets now are high-rise condominiums with names like Napa Valley. the Marxist economy has been so dismantled by this point that you see little traces of that. And the only times I would see, you know, Chairman Mao or a Communist Party sloganeering was, you know, faded paint on old brick walls, the way you sort of see rusting fallout shelters on signs on American post offices, or in cities sometimes outside of like a statue of Chairman Mao, you would see recently laid off people prostrating themselves before that statue, leaving flowers and praying to Chairman Mao, the statue anyway, this icon, for a new job, for employment.
So he's kind of becoming the Virgin Mary or something.
St. Mao, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, China has spent more years, it's true, someone in the book says this, they've spent more years dismantling a Marxist economy now than they did ever building one. In the rural regions, that's much more apparent because in the rural regions, farmers no longer pay taxes. There's no agricultural taxes anymore in China. There's no mandatory procurement of grains anymore in China. Farmers are free to choose the seeds they want to use and where they want to sell their crop. And so their attachment to the Maoist years is much more familial, you know, much more about, oh, there was camaraderie then, and we were all much closer as a village. I think it's kind of funny, actually, because my mother-in-law for years would rail against communist policy and how it affected the family. But now, as she's in her 70s, too, she slips back into this nostalgia. You know, I'll say, wait a minute, you told me those were lean years. And she's like, yes, but at least we had each other. We were so much closer then.
Well, the world is always going to hell in a handbasket when you get older. I'm sure Auntie Yi complains about that, too.
She does all the time. And, of course, her complaint, though, is that she thinks things should be controlled by the party. You know, she wants to go back to those times, I think. Part of that is because she could meddle in people's affairs, perhaps, and have some control over what was happening in the village. And now it's the company that's doing that instead of the party.
Well, it would have been better for you, I guess, if she had more power.
I think so, yeah. And this is a bit of a misnomer, too. I'm always asking her, you know, who has the power? People in Beijing would often ask me, whose city is this? You know, they don't know who their mayor is, or if they do, they certainly didn't elect him or her, very rarely her. In Wasteland, the village, the farmers would often tell me, you know, well, we're the ones who make the decisions for how this village is shaped and, you know, what it grows and how it grows. But in the course of reporting this book, you know, starting in the early 2000s, it was the company that was making those decisions, and it was doing it behind closed doors, which was really hard for some of the villagers to understand, let alone comprehend.
You mentioned, Michael Meyer, you mentioned these trains that travel through, and you took those trains, and it's pretty remarkable how you were able to get around. That seems... It's almost European, the number of trains and where you can go.
That's a really good point. One thing I liked about living in this region is that the trains go everywhere. Because the Russians built, they started the railway system there by building a shortcut between Moscow and Vladivostok through the north of China here. That was part of the Trans-Siberian line. Then they built a trunk line heading south to an ice-free port called Port Arthur. And it's now Dalian Lushan on the Yellow Sea. Then the Japanese, when they occupied the region, their trains ran on coal. And so they started opening coal mines around there as well. And then as the Japanese home islands faced embargoes and different measures, economic measures against it during the war, they amped up production in this area of rice, of other grains, of raw materials and resources. And so they laid these railroad tracks to penetrate into these remote areas that you can still travel today. And so it was wonderful for me because I hate bus travel anyway, especially in China. But for here, you can travel almost into every nook and cranny by rail, which is a reason I actually recommend people visit this area. Even if you don't speak Chinese, it's much easier to get around up there than it is in central China or southern China.
And this is the city of Harbin. Many years ago, a few decades ago, my former co-host on a show we did called Probabilities gave me a book called The Russian Fascists, which was about white Russians and how they wanted to take back their land. And some of the stories were very strange. A guy who created a white Russian navy, however, it was a miniature navy on his lawn in Connecticut. But a large chunk of that book was about the city of Harbin.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to go to Harbin very desperately, and you got there.
I did. I recommend people go there. So when the Qing dynasty, the Manchu dynasty, allowed the Russians to build this railroad across the northeast, just cutting across again from Moscow to Vladivostok, the agreement was you could not enter existing cities because that would disturb the city's feng shui. We don't want you to penetrate old city walls. We don't want you to run by old cemeteries. And so Russia constructed these railroad towns, and Harbin was the most prominent of them. And this was the city, as I mentioned earlier, that had 53 nationalities speaking 45 languages. It had the largest Jewish population of the Far East. There was a Siberia-Palestine newspaper that came out weekly. There's still a Russian Jewish cemetery there now. and some of the synagogues are being restored by the government. But this was, if I could time travel to any era or place of Manchurian history, I'd go back to 1920s Harbin, when you had white Russians who had fled the Bolshevik Revolution, who were living off, you know, selling their treasures and their jewels around their neck, and you'd have generals walking down the street with their epaulets and stuff on their uniforms still. Plus, you had the secret agents from the Bolshevik, the communists, spying on them and keeping tabs on what they were doing there. Plus, you had these Chinese warlords that were in the area. Plus, you had communist guerrillas creeping in. Then you had Japanese secret agents. And this was all playing out in this city, which today is quite pleasant to visit because, unlike other Chinese cities that were colonized, Harbin wears this badge quite proudly. It's a tourist attraction now. When these state-owned enterprises started closing in the 90s, the cities of the Northeast, these Manchurian cities, said, well, what do we have that, let's say, Shanghai or Chengdu or Wuhan or Xi'an doesn't have? We have these old, cool colonial buildings, which they've reopened as, quote-unquote, patriotic education bases. They're museums to this era of colonization, but they're quite wonderful to walk through, and you can still stay in these restored hotels that Russia built 100 years ago or Japan ran 80 years ago.
The last emperor, mm-hmm. Puyi, you familiar with the Bertolucci movie?
Yes.
Okay. How close is that to reality?
Very true, actually. And that movie begins with a harrowing scene of Puyi being sent back across the border into China after being captured by the Russians when he tried to flee and he was held in a Siberian camp. The movie begins with him crossing into China, and he's certain that he's going to be killed on sight. And he actually goes into the toilet of the train station there on the Chinese side of the border to try to kill himself. And according to his diary, this is true.
So that would be a fairly good introduction to his history.
Yeah, you know, Puyi is one of the saddest people I've ever encountered, not only in Chinese history but in world history, in that he was put on the throne as an infant, served only a few years before the Qing dynasty fell. Although he was Manchu, he had never actually been to Manchuria. He lived his entire life in Beijing. Even after abdication, he was allowed to stay in the Forbidden City as a sort of figurehead or part of it. And then he had an opportunity to what his tutor, his British tutor, had hoped that he would go to Oxford and sort of be a scholar and live out his days there. And when a warlord evicted Puyi from the Forbidden City in the 1920s in Beijing, the British embassy, the legation there, wouldn't let him in, said, no, we don't want to get involved in Chinese politics. And so instead, Puyi went across the street to the Japanese legation, and he was put up by the Japanese, who eventually put him in a big villa in Tianjin, a port city about an hour's train ride from Beijing. And then in the 1930s, he was put secretly on a ship and brought to Manchuria, which he had never visited before, even though he was, you know, emperor of the Manchu, and was told by the Japanese, you will be put on the throne again, you will reunite the Manchu people in this homeland. But he was a puppet. He was a figurehead for Manchukuo, the puppet state they had there.
That's another part of in Manchuria, the section dealing with the Japanese mm-hmm. occupation. One of the untold stories, and I had never heard of this, is how many farmers went there and how many thousands of members of their family, women and children, died at the end of the war.
The Japanese farms were collapsing in the 1930s, and there was a notion that they had a campaign called the Millions to Manchuria campaign, and it would be that you would take second and third children from a village in Japan, so not the firstborn. They'd stay at home in Japan, but second sons, second daughters, third daughters would get on a ship, go to northeast China, start a farm there, start a new village matching the name of the village they had come from in Japan, so it would be a mirror society was the idea. These Japanese farmers that signed up for this were told they were getting 25 unopened acres of farmland that they would open themselves and cultivate for production. They were told they'd have a mule and a rake and a hoe. When they actually got off the ship, they found that they were often occupying land that had been seized from native farmers, sometimes bayoneted to be forced off the land, and they were issued a single bolt action rifle. And they were put in areas along the Russian border or in areas of heavy, what Japan called bandit, but was really guerrilla warfare, you know, people fighting against Japanese occupation. And they were put out in these areas to sort of defend the borders of Manchukuo unwittingly. And when the war was coming to an end for Japan and the Soviet Union started massing its troops on the Manchurian border to invade, the Japanese military turned tail and ran. And a Japanese general wrote in a cable of these women and children, their only alternative is suicide. And they were left behind. And indeed, there was 300,000 of these farmers, and the highest percentage of casualties of Japanese in Manchuria were these farmers, equal to the amount of people who were killed at Nagasaki, actually. And there are some harrowing scenes in the book where I go back to these areas where Japanese women were waiting for rescue ships to arrive, and those ships never came. And so they placed their children, their infant babies, on the shore, and they stepped into the river to commit suicide. And those children were adopted by local Chinese farmers and raised that way. And so that history is ever present. You know, the war is still going on in some ways in the Northeast.
And there are signs of the Japanese everywhere still.
There are, not only in the architecture that's left behind. You know, you still see these imperial buildings or Shinto war temples, those sort of shrines that are left behind. But you'll go to villages in the Northeast where the street signs are in Japanese. You know, they're Chinese still first and then Japanese after, because there are these villages where these orphaned Japanese children were raised by Chinese families. And to the point where in the book, I visit a cemetery, a Sino-Japanese friendship garden, they call it, the cemetery, that Zhou Enlai, the premier of China himself, dedicated in the 1960s and said, you know, these Japanese civilians were also victims of the war. We cannot demonize them. And in some counties in the Northeast, you know, there's still an exchange that happens annually where Japanese descendants will come back over to tend the graves of these people, or Chinese in these villages will go over to Japan to work because they have cousins or they have aunts and uncles and so forth that have connections to Japan. So it's a more fraught, much more intimate relationship with Japan and that war than you see elsewhere in China.
You didn't run across any of the children or grandchildren of those Japanese babies, though.
I did, actually. I went to Tokyo. This didn't make it into the book because it was really too far afield. It was such a huge backstory to describe, because I did go to Tokyo and interview women who went to Japan for the first time in their 70s. They moved back to Japan. And the sight of them sitting in a Japanese language classroom learning basic Japanese and beginning a very small living settlement to try to make their way in Tokyo. And it was quite sad, and it required a lot of backstory that just didn't fit into the book. But those people exist, and that's still going on.
Is that how you were able to find the one Japanese male survivor?
The Japanese male survivor was completely by happenstance, in that in the book I talk about a Japanese soldier who was sent over quite late in the war and was there when the Soviets crossed the border, and he went on the run, and he ended up being on the run for 8 years in Manchuria. The way I met this gentleman is through my grandmother, because she would visit his nursery and organic farm in Santa Cruz County on, of all things, Freedom Boulevard. I love the symmetry of that. But this Japanese man, he survived the war, 8 years on the run, was eventually repatriated back to Japan, and one day saw an ad in a newspaper saying Watsonville strawberry growers need people to pick their crop, and got on a ship and came over to America and ended up running a farm here, and he's still alive.
You also went down to Port Arthur, mm-hmm. which is now
Lushun, just south of Dalian. Readers might know, or listeners might know Dalian.
I never got the story of why Port Arthur and a place called Port Arthur that stayed Port Arthur for so long.
You know, I never understood that either. Who was this Arthur? I thought it was like a German prince or something like that, but that's a good question. I believe it was the British who named it originally, because they had a concession just across the Gulf from there where they would have shipping traffic going through. But yeah, now it's Lushun in Chinese.
There are high-speed trains in the north, mm-hmm. and through the rest of China. We can't do that here, and it's very odd because it seems that China is in the 22nd century and the 19th. Does that make sense?
It absolutely does. You know, this is one of the bewildering things about being in China, is you're constantly coming up with contradictions such as this. Like, why is it that the country has this very advanced high-speed rail network but can't figure out how to get an ambulance, you know, into an inner-city accident site on time? Those contradictions exist all over the place, yeah.
And you went to the border of North Korea.
I did, and the Koreans played an enormous role in the shaping of the Northeast, because it was Korean settlers in the 1910s and 20s who introduced rice as a viable crop here. I think maybe listeners are surprised that you can grow rice in such a cold climate. It's a single crop. They only plant late April. They harvest in September, and it's a sticky short-grain rice that we often eat in sushi. It's really a boutique crop that does quite well. That was the Koreans who introduced it. And I am, the province I'm in is along the North Korean border. There are North Korean refugees in this area. There's a little enclave of them quite near to Wasteland where illegals are living. And the trouble I had with the police at one point in the book was they suspected that I might be a missionary, because they thought, you know, South Koreans do pass through the area and minister to these people. And there was some question about that.
Is there any difference in the taste between the rice that we have here and, say, fresh rice?
You know, okay, I grew up in a rural area of Minnesota, and even as a child, I always laugh when people could say, boy, this fresh egg I have tastes so much better than what I get at the supermarket. But that might be my taste buds. I'm not discounting that. I believe fresh food is very good, and you should eat local and all of that. But people in Wasteland are so proud of their rice, and they smack their lips and say it is the best-tasting rice they've ever had. The market would agree because it's organically grown and it's priced quite high, and it's a very popular product. To me, it tastes like rice, quite frankly. But to the point where I have, you know, relatives in the South, for example, who live in cities, who eagerly want me, when I come back from Wasteland, to bring them the rice that they grew up eating, right, in their village, which is lovely, right? And they think it tastes so much better.
Manchurian cuisine, mm-hmm. How is that different from what we get served here, even at more authentic Chinese restaurants?
I think anytime, if you think of just northern Chinese cuisine, you're eating what was, you know, historically Manchurian cuisine. So anybody who's, if you're eating dumplings, often stuffed with pork, chives, pork, and cabbage. The big dish up in the Northeast is sour cabbage. You see cabbages stacked up outside of houses because they last throughout the winter as a form of nourishment. So it's really a cabbage-based cuisine. And that's a funny thing, too, is that older people, you know, when I'd say, like, wow, Walmart's here, that's something else, I'll say, oh, we're so happy because in wintertime now we can buy mangoes and pineapples. And I'll say, yeah, but mangoes and pineapples aren't seasonal, are they? And they say, listen, if you grew up eating cabbage as your only fruit or vegetable for 6 months out of the year, you'd be delighted to take a break from that vile, you know, vegetable that they don't want to eat anymore. So cabbage and dumplings mostly.
Censorship. Mm-hmm. Did you see much signs of it?
China's shooting itself in the foot, frankly, and going out of its way to make things more problematic than it needs to be, especially for Internet, for example, where when I lived there from 2010 to about 2013, I had a virtual private network installed on my computer. So in the farmhouse, I could access Western sites and I could use Gmail and stuff like that. But I often didn't need the virtual private network because out in the countryside, it felt like I could look at more media sites and more Western sites than I could in the city. But now that's completely changed. Virtual private networks have all but been shut down by the government in the last 2 months. And it's really difficult for journalists, including Chinese journalists, who rely on Gmail, who rely on Google, and other things to use for their work. And so it's one of these annoying things that China does that, frankly, it doesn't need to do. But it's choosing to do so to show who controls the Internet. So that's an annoyance. With publishing, there are so many books that come out every year in China. 200,000-plus books are published in China that I think I got lucky with the Beijing book in a way in that it sort of sneaked through past the censor. It was published by a Shanghai publisher, which helped. It wasn't a Beijing-based publisher. It was more a market-oriented publisher, not a political-oriented publisher. I think the Manchuria book is going to be a tougher row to hoe because of the history of the Japanese occupation I detail and also a pretty terrible massacre that the communists inflicted upon a city in the Northeast to secure victory in the region.
There's a review that's on your website by a Chinese publication, and that review talked about how great the writing was and how wonderful the story of Wasteland was, but how terrible the writing was when you visited museums and when you gave the history. And I kept thinking, this ties in more with the current ideology than anything else.
Of course. Of course. Well, this is a real issue, right? Who gets to interpret history? And frankly, how can a foreigner step into one of our patriotic education bases and explain to the reader what's going on between the lines here? You know, all museums tell stories. Chinese museums tell political stories. And those political stories all have the same ending. The Communist Party won. And if it weren't for the Communist Party, there would be no new China. And when you get into more fraught areas like a World War II prisoner of war camp where survivors of the Bataan Death March were held and an American parachuted in armed only with a pistol and amidst 30,000 Japanese soldiers and had to explain to them that the war was over, and when you start getting into his telling of history, that can become difficult for readers in China. I'm like, well, wait a minute, this isn't a version we know, right? I have to say that the positive side of this is that the Beijing book hasn't received that reaction, thankfully. And I've done a book tour in China for the Beijing book. That was an example, again, of that's something a lot of Chinese writers haven't tackled that subject before, so it was new to them. But you're right. If I'm writing about the farm, that's new to a Chinese audience. But if I'm writing about museums, well, now we're getting into politics, and that's a whole other breed of cat.
Yet, at the same time, of course, the book is available in English there, I guess.
It is. And, you know, nowadays, adept Chinese university students, high school students, journalists and readers of all ilk, you know how to use the Internet and know how to find this information online and find it if they want to. And an uncensored version will come out in Taiwan and be sold in Hong Kong. And so people bring it over the border and those ways of doing it, too.
In Hong Kong. So in that sense, Hong Kong still remains a very separate entity from the rest.
Culturally, yes. It's increasingly becoming less so, I should say. When I was teaching at the University of Hong Kong a couple of years ago, it was clear already that the student body was changing, and so was control over the curriculum of the university. But you're right. When you go to the Hong Kong airport or a Hong Kong bookstore, you'll often see mainland tourists stuffing suitcases and boxes and bags full of books they couldn't otherwise get on the other side of the border.
It seems then that even if they're trying for this kind of censorship,
mm-hmm.
they can't quite do it. And when you talk about them shutting down parts of the Internet,
yeah.
we know for a fact that there are a lot of people out there, particularly people who are high-tech, mm-hmm. even in places like Wasteland,
yeah.
who know how to get around that
That's
stuff.
That's true. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny, too, because these things wax and wane, especially with America and China. Like, on the one hand, you have the Internet and the harassment of journalists trying to do their job or visas being denied for American correspondents. On the other hand, I just went and got my new visa at the Chinese consulate, and I received a 10-year visa in my passport. I wrote 2 books in China over a period of 10 years, basically on tourist visas and 3- and 6-month visas that I constantly had to have renewed or leave the country to get a new visa. And now here we are in this era of supposedly closing doors and tightening of content and restrictions and such like that, but I have a 10-year visa now to visit the country, which is wonderful.
This is going to be a strange question because mm-hmm. it comes out of a footnote. There's a man named Hu Hong in Harbin.
Yes.
Runs a cafe, and a friend of his committed suicide, and that's mm-hmm. only in the footnote, but apparently you spoke with her.
She was a friend, actually. She was somebody, I should call her an acquaintance, but she's somebody who was a photographer who showed me a lot of the old buildings in Harbin that weren't being prettified for tourists, that places that she had lived and she had gone and captured the art in. And she was in her mid-40s, actually, when she committed suicide. The reason I put that as a footnote is this happened after the fact that I was there. I didn't talk to her about it. I didn't know the state of her being at the time that this happened. The gentleman who explains to me what happened said that she essentially had a nervous breakdown, and it had to do with her son deciding not to attend college. I don't know if that's true or not. And she threw herself from a window, actually, and that's how it happened. And it's hard when you're doing a book like this, when you have characters, you can only have so many characters in the main pages, and you have all these sidelights that you want to tuck in somehow. And so that ended up in the footnotes. I'm glad you read the footnotes. Thank you. In some ways, I think book footnotes are as interesting as the main text, you know? Yeah.
Well, it felt as if many of these footnotes were actually in the main text
they
and were pulled.
They were, yeah. There's whole scenes, and that's a good point. There are scenes in the footnotes even, you know, where we go to some other place and see some other slide of history that was pulled out.
And you did that for, I guess, to compress the story a little
bit. I think there's only so much information a reader can hold, and you want to keep the suspense. You want to keep a reader turning the page, especially about a foreign place. And so I really did hone it down to 4 or 5 characters and the changes that were going on in their lives. And those side characters had to go, unfortunately.
One of the questions I often ask is, what did you leave out? And in this yeah. case, you can see what you left
yeah.
out.
Well, that's a good point. The publisher actually told me, no, put all that in the footnotes. That's good stuff. It just doesn't need to be in the main body. And that was nice. Otherwise, I see writers these days often putting things on their website, which I don't know how many readers actually go to that. It's almost like seeing the director's cut of a movie where you go, we like the 2-hour version of Apocalypse Now. We don't need to see the 3.5-hour version of it. But in this case, I did put those things in the back of the book.
Well, one thing I would like on your website, which isn't there, would be more photos, actually.
Yeah, that's great. And, one thing I'm happy about this book is there is a color photo insert, a 16-page insert of what this place looks like. But you're right. I have thousands of photos. When I do book talks, I'm showing slides in the talk because the images are really, really compelling, I think, because this area looks nothing like a wasteland. It looks a lot like northern Sonoma County. You know, it's a fertile floodplain with foothills that stretch out. It's quite lovely there, and the people look different, and the architecture looks different.
What is pronounced wasteland in Chinese?
Huangdi.
That sounds a lot better.
It does, doesn't it? It's funny, too, because the villages around there have names like Mudtown and Lonely Outpost and the Dunes and Zhang Smelly Ditch. And I did find in the book when the village was founded. It was founded in 1722, but I could never get a clear answer on why these places had these horrible names. But the theory is, of villagers, is that they gave these places these names so other migrants wouldn't settle there and bandits would pass on by, because the soil is so rich and is so fertile. And if listeners can picture like holding spent coffee grounds, that's how dark and moist the soil is. And so I like that theory, that people gave it these awful names so you keep on walking and not stop.
Well, I noticed also that over the years, the Americanized or Anglicized versions of names have disappeared. So the only thing left of Peking is Peking duck.
That's right. That's a good point. Peking opera, maybe.
And Harbin has always been Harbin, though, I guess.
It is. And in English, we say Harbin, H-A-R-B-I-N. In Chinese, you say Ha-Arbin. It's got three syllables instead. Yeah.
Is Shanghai Shanghai?
Shanghai is still Shanghai. But, you know, it's funny, Guangzhou, which is Canton, is actually, I see, using Canton more in its promotional materials and its tourism thing, because Westerners see that, you know, they know that. In Beijing, the university, the top university, is Peking University. And they've gone through a long argument the last decade about, well, we're called Beijing now. Shouldn't we call our university Beijing University? And people say, well, no, it's Peking University historically. And so they still use that English name.
Did a lot of names change after the revolution?
They did. And, you know, things like Beijing, the Peking comes from the Latin translation of Beijing that Jesuits did in the 18th century. And so in Chinese, it's always been Beijing, except for the times when it wasn't the capital. It was named Beiping. But in 1975, when the communists finally said, you know, forget using Peking in English, we're going to go to the Romanized version of the way we say it, Beijing, that's when it's officially been changed. But the rest of it, you know, it's the spelling system more. So you see things like Chongqing in traditional, you know, this southwestern Chinese city, which in Chinese now is Chongqing. It's just a different romanization system that they're using now.
And Manchuria, again, is not Manchuria there.
Right, it's Dongbei. It means the northeast. And, you know, it's funny, Western intellectuals often will ask me now, like, Manchuria, isn't that a sensitive word? And I'll think, I wonder if New England was ever a sensitive term. Like after the Revolution, if people in Massachusetts said, don't call us New England anymore, we're Massachusetts now or something else. The word Manchuria sort of fell from favor after the Korean War, when the Communist Party did finally assume full control of the Northeast and started calling it the Northeast instead. But as I point out in the book, the Communist Party did use Manchuria in its correspondence for years, and the name Manchuria long predates the Japanese occupation there. It goes back to the 18th century.
Michael Meyer, now that this book is out, mm-hmm. and I guess you'll do a tour in China.
Yes.
Are you working on another book?
I am, and I'm split right down the middle. If I want to do something, I've been spending the last couple months in archives in Philadelphia looking at Benjamin Franklin's last will and testament and this wonderful bet that Franklin made on America, that he said, I'm going to leave a sum of money behind in a bank account, and if America's still around in 100 years, you can access that money with all the compound interest on it. If America's still around in 200 years, you can access an even larger amount of that money. And so I've spent winter sort of tracing where that money has gone and where it's ended up. And so I'm quite enamored by this. I like the idea of switching gears a bit and doing a book outside of China and something about American history for a change. So I think that's where I'm going.
And Peter Hessler's writing about Egypt, so there you go.
Exactly. This is shelf life. Well, I think we're all very acutely aware of what happened to Pearl Buck. And Pearl Buck not only was never allowed to go back to China once she left, because she had so angered the communist officials there, Pearl Buck was also painted as a Red here in the States, and she ended up writing a series of books under the pen name John Sedges about the American West from her Pennsylvania farm. Not very good books, you know, in her oeuvre, but she's an example of maybe you want to diversify a bit, because China can be quite fickle politically, whether you're not allowed back in the country or how people here might view you.
When are you going back to Wasteland?
The plan right now is to go back to Wasteland in the summertime and actually bring my son, my toddler son, and introduce him to the villagers, who I'm sure will smother him with kisses and hugs and everything else and stuff him with dumplings. They can't wait to see him.
You've been listening to an interview with Michael Meyer, whose book is titled In Manchuria, A Village Called Wasteland and the Transformation of Rural China. I'm Richard Walensky on BookWaves.